Questions? So we had a couple of topics left over from sound, and then we started to talk about light last time. So it seems like a really funny question, but I think that it's a useful one to think about, and that's why doesn't the atmosphere fall down? It's made out of little rocks, atoms, and we know that rocks fall down. Why doesn't the atmosphere fall down? What's holding it up? There has to be some force that's countering gravity. And what we said is that what that force is pressure difference. You know that when you go down in the ocean, whether you go down in the ocean of air or the ocean of water, the pressure gets more and more and more, right? So on top of Mount Everest, the pressure is less than it is here. So if we think about an object, we got more pressure on the bottom pushing up than we have pressure on the top that's pushing down. So that pressure difference is providing a net force up, sometimes it's called the buoyant force, that's canceling the force of gravity. And I know we don't have a big use for equations in this course, but technically speaking, what we have is the change in pressure, delta P, is equal to rho. Rho is the density, the mass per unit volume, times the acceleration of gravity, times how far down in the atmosphere or ocean we've gone. Doppler effect. So Doppler effect is an apparent change in the frequency or wavelength. They're, of course, interrelated. If you increase the frequency, you've decreased the wavelength. It's a change in the frequency or wavelength that depends on the source and the receiver coming together, in which case the sound would go to higher frequencies, or moving apart, in which case the frequency would go to longer wavelengths. So we listen to the blaring car going by us with its horn. The pitch is higher when it's approaching, and it's lower when it's receding from us. And technically speaking, again, we don't have a big use for equations. The change in wavelength divided by the wavelength is about equal to the speed that they're coming together or moving apart divided by the wave speed, speed of sound or speed of light, depending upon which wave we're talking about. Works for both of them. So if things are approaching, we've got a shorter wavelength and a higher frequency. When things are moving apart, we have a longer wavelength and a lower frequency. And we played with that helicopter application that was online. Questions? So we introduced, I think it was two times ago, this kind of graphic equalizer idea. That is to say that we can quantify the amount of sound at different wavelengths and graphically display it. And what we have then is a plot of the various frequencies or wavelengths, you can take your pick, and the amount of sound at those wavelengths. So if suddenly the bass guitar goes on, then the amount of sound in the bass is going to go up. Right? If a flute plays, then the amount of sound at that particular wavelength in the treble is going to go up. So this is a plot then of the amount of sound versus frequency or wavelength. Doesn't make a big difference. If we're thinking about something like music, where the sounds are actually orchestrated, then generally speaking, there isn't sound at every conceivable wavelength, right? Everyone is playing a particular orchestrated note. So for example, somebody might be playing a C chord, so we have C, E, G, and maybe the next harmonic C being played, but we have no sound at this frequency, that frequency, that frequency, that frequency, that frequency. We got lots of sound at this particular thing of C. So these are the two that we can talk about most easily in terms of sound. This is called the continuous spectra. It's typically be a random process, right, because it's not orchestrated. All the various frequencies are present. And here we have an orchestrated spectra. And we looked at one of these online applications that showed how you could do something a little bit different in the case of light. So if you start with a noise spectra, but you put something between you and the source of light that absorbs particular wavelengths, then you can have an absence of light at this frequency and an absence of light at that frequency. So that's called an absorption spectra. And unfortunately, there are lots of synonyms for these various types of spectra. So in the case of light, this sort of continuous spectra, our book calls it a blackbody spectra. You could also call it a thermal spectra, a Planck spectra. the spectra of an incandescent light bulb, the Edison-type light bulbs. This sort of orchestrated spectra, sometimes it's called the bright line spectra or an emission spectra, where we'll see eventually that it's the light that's produced by these fluorescent light bulbs. And this spectra is sometimes called the dark line spectra. So lots of names for the same thing. So we have all the wavelengths present in kind of equal amounts, that's a continuous spectra. If we just have a few wavelengths present, that's an emission spectra. If we have mostly the same amount except for some absences, that's an absorption spectra. Okay, and so this applies as much to any wave, light or sound, makes no difference. So we went on to talk about light, and light, unlike sound, can travel through a vacuum, and so it doesn't require any stuff. It's not made out of stuff. Remember that sound is made out of atoms pushed together into compressions and separated out into rarefactions, but light is made out of electric and magnetic fields, stuff that can exist just fine in a vacuum. So we saw with that stack set of sheets that if light is going this way, say, we would have a region of lots of electromagnetic stuff, a region of reversed electromagnetic stuff, back to the same situation of lots, and of course in between no electromagnetic stuff, and then one wavelength would be the distance between two of the same sorts of things. In the case of visible light, those waves are very closely packed. The wavelength would be about half of a millionth of a meter, so it's not particularly noticeable. In the case of other types of light, like radio, they can be separated by noticeable distances, like a meter. So we have various names for colors of light that we don't experience ourselves. We have radio. AM radio turns out to be the lowest common frequency. Megahertz, FM radio is typically at hundreds of megahertz. TV is typically at about the same spot. Microwaves, maybe gigahertz, that is to say billions of waves a second. Infrared light, the light that's just below the red light. Then we have visible light with these kind of names of colors, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet. And then we have light that's at even higher frequency than what our eyes can detect, that's ultraviolet light. And higher wavelength, higher frequency yet, X-ray light and gamma ray light. And we notice kind of in passing that these sorts of light are ones you should be worried about. Those are all things that cause people to die. Unless you put your cat in the microwave, these things, generally speaking, are harmless and don't kill people. In order to make this sort of spectral piece, we need something that is able to divide up light according to its frequency. And we looked at a couple of things. We looked at prisms. So prisms were able to separate the red dot from the green dot. And it turns out that prisms are actually relatively ineffective at separating light. They do bend 100% of the light, but the amount they bend the red light and the green light is pretty comparable. And it's kind of hard to see when we looked at the kind of quick and dirty demo of it. Right, so here I've got my red and green dots. And if you look carefully, you'll note, actually the red and green are pretty much exactly in a line. And if I insert this prism, notice that the red has made maybe half, or the green has moved maybe half an inch more than the red. So in terms of actually separating, it's bent the light. Well, lots of things will bend light. But what it's done is it's actually bent it differentially, so that if the red and the green were together originally, the green would be out in front now. So it's a pretty small effect. If you have a large enough distance, you can make kind of a noticeable separation. Oh, you can't see this at all, can you? I know there's a picture I took of such a rainbow in the New Science Building. You can see the scale at least. Of the separation is comparable to my hand. That's just because they've gone through a bigger range of angles. Okay, but CDs have rainbows too, And they actually turn out to be more effective and a cheaper way of breaking up light with what's called a diffraction grating. So with a diffraction grating, and I won't try and turn off the lights, the most thing that's obvious is that nothing happens. But if we turned off the lights, you would see that there are dots to the left and to the right where a small fraction of the light has been deflected. And for the prism, the green light was deflected more than the red light. For this diffraction grating, the red light would be deflected more than the green light. And all this diffraction grating consists of, all a CD consists of, is lots of parallel lines. So somehow or other, the existence of lots of parallel lines is able to break light up into its component parts. Questions? So I was kind of amused. We talked last time a little bit about maroon. It turns out that, I don't think this is the right one. Here it is. Maroon actually has different definitions. So to some people, maroon is just dark red, and to other people, it is a version of purple. And the kind of upshot of all of this, if you go to like a wiki page, is that now, all of these various colors have names and can be quantified according to the amount of the three primary colors, the amount of red, so-called red, green, and blue. So I don't know, you can cursor down here and see, you know, pretty much every imaginable color and the corresponding amounts of red, green, and blue that are necessary to make up that color. And while this may be impressive, I think actually the reverse is the thing to take away from this. For music, we would never think about having, you know, even this long a list that contained every possible type of music. So for music, we have very sensitive detection systems of the simultaneous presence of lots of different frequencies, and we have a kind of a much larger range of possibilities. Four colors than even this pretty long list of named colors. While we're here, we might as well remind you of the picture we had of the absorption spectra. So here we have a white light source which is simultaneously producing little bits of light, photons of all of these various colors, and everything is present, so the spectrum shows pretty much the same amount of all of these various colors. If I insert a gas cloud, it turns out that gas has the property that it absorbs particularly colors of light. So a photon that is of exactly this wavelength is going to be highly likely to be absorbed by that cloud, whereas one that's just a little bit shorter or longer wavelength is not going to be affected by the cloud. So that's our absorption spectra. And here's kind of what we'll be looking at today. So here we have what the sun's light looks like. Pretty much all of the colors of the rainbow in pretty much equal amounts. If we have a cooler object, it looks red. So it has a predominance of red light in it. And we'll see, I don't know if we'll see this next time or this time, for things like neon lamps, they produce what's called emission spectra, where we have lots of different individual colors, but there's no light at this color and that color and that color and that color. For something that's hotter than the sun, it's going to produce a preponderance of blue light, but it still has colors of all of the rainbow, so this is just going to look like kind of a whitish blue as opposed to a vibrant blue. And of course, the reason that generally speaking, your clothes have various colors is because they are reflecting ambient light, so sunlight or the fluorescent light. So here we have the reflected light of a leaf. So here's the light that's shining on it, and here's what the leaf is, you know, excreting, as it were, right? Not using for any useful purpose, and that's this basically green light. So at least because leaves are green, people sometimes have the confusion that green light would be good for plants, right? But it's exactly the opposite. Plants have no use for green light. They're happier with everything else that isn't green. Green is essentially what they're excreting, not using at all. Questions? Well, let's spend a little bit more time thinking about these spectra, because they're going to play an important role for us. And here we have a spectra. So here we've decided to graph wavelength on the x-axis. So here we have the amount of light that has a wavelength of 400 nanometers. That's 4.4 millionths of a meter. So for this first spectra, we have that amount of light. For the second spectra, we have that amount of light. And of course, we could read it over on the y-axis if we wanted to. And here we have this amount of light. So you can see, kind of immediately, that this guy has more light at every conceivable wavelength. And this turns out to be the light that's produced by a fairly hot object. This is a slightly cooler object, and this is a slightly cooler object, too. So if we increase the temperature of an object, we get more light at every possible wavelength. And in addition, there's a little bit of color shift. So this very hot object, this is hotter than the surface of the sun, the peak wavelength is occurring in the blue, whereas this object, which is pretty comparable to the sun, the peak wavelength is occurring in kind of the yellow-orange. So the peak is where this bell-shaped curve has its maximum. So this has a peak wavelength that's a little bit less than 600. This has a peak wavelength that's probably, 470 or something like that. And this has a peak wavelength that is maybe 420 or so. Okay, so the online quiz deals with dealing with these sort of graphs. Reading numbers off. So here we have two spectra. In this case, we've decided to use wavelength in millionths of a meter. So these two graphs are identical, except this one has more light at every wavelength, right? So there's no shift in the peak wavelength between these two. This one is just a scaled down version of that. So you could achieve this, for example, just by moving the light source further from you, right? It would be dimmer if it's further away from you. You could also put some sort of filter, neutral filter in there that was just always absorbing, looks like about half of the light, in order to have that variation. Okay, and here's the distinction we were looking at a moment ago between hot objects and cold objects. So here we have an object that has a temperature a little bit hotter than the surface of the sun, 6,000 degrees, and here's an object that is just 4,000 degrees. So the differences are that this guy has less light at every wavelength, right? So at this wavelength here, which is about 1.3 millionths of a meter, this guy has an amount of light that I can read off, maybe 3 or so nanowatts per square meter per micrometer, whereas this other one has considerably more, maybe 8 nanowatts per square meter per micrometer. Okay, so you can read these things pretty directly to get the amount of light versus wavelength. And just to be specific about it, this is actually the spectra of the sun. And you can see that it has zillions of little absorption lines in it. Some of them aren't so little. But generally speaking, it's pretty similar to those bell-shaped curves, right? We can't pick out exactly where the peak wavelength is, but it's someplace in here. We've got all of these little absorption lines. So in this case, the sun's light has to go through the sun's atmosphere, so there are lots of various chemicals in the sun's atmosphere. In fact, basically everything in the periodic table. And so we get lots of little absorption lines from basically every possibility that's there. Okay, questions? Let's kind of take a look at this more or less directly with our own eyes. So what we've got here is some devices whose temperature I can change by turning these knobs. see how it goes. So right now I see absolutely nothing. I see black, which is the absence of light. But now I at least, I don't know if you can start to see this kind of dull orange from this kind of toaster filament sort of thing. So this thing was always producing light, but it was producing light that we couldn't see. And now we have, as it's heated up, it's starting to produce some light that's tripping into the red part of the spectra. If I increase its temperature, it gets a lot brighter, right? So now I can see reflected light from it, whereas before I could just barely see it. And it's getting a little bit yellower as opposed to the kind of deep orange that it was before. Okay, so that's about as hot as we can get with something that is exposed to the atmosphere. What we've got here is basically the same thing, a filament, but it's enclosed in a glass envelope, so it can reach considerably higher temperatures than the... I think I turned it the wrong way. So here's the really exactly the same thing. We've got a little bit of wire whose temperature I can change by turning this knob. And, you know, we can start with kind of this dull orange glow, and as we increase the temperature, what are the changes that we see? So these are called incandescent light bulbs in contrast to these fluorescent light bulbs. The only thing that's happening is they're hot. There isn't any special mechanism inside there. They're shining just because they're hot, and that's exactly what incandescence means. So as I increase the temperature of those bulbs, what happens? So the hugely most obvious factor that happens is they become much brighter. And we can show actually that the amount of light they produce depends on the temperature to the fourth. So if I just double the temperature of that filament, I get 16 times as much light. So a pretty modest change in the temperature of those light bulbs does hugely different stuff. And the other effect that I was mentioning is subtler, and I'm not sure if you believe me or not, that I would call that light now kind of yellowish white, but at lower temperature, in addition to there being less light, the color is different. It's orangish. And we saw with the toaster oven thing, it was almost reddish. So in addition to the shift in the amount of light, we get a color shift. It starts out as this reddish orange. And it works its way up to white, yellow white. And it turns out that's about as hot as you can make something before it evaporates. But the sun is not made out of solid objects. It is hotter. And if we increase the temperature still more, it would be white hot. And if we increase the temperature still more, it would end up being kind of blue white. If things, you know, kind of made sense, we'd go from red hot to yellow hot to green hot to blue hot, right? That progression maybe makes a little bit more sense. But what's happening is because this is a continuous spectra, when we get something that has a peak wavelength in the blue, it comes with it all of this other colors of light. So it only becomes slightly blue-white, whereas this thing here still has all of the colors of the rainbow, and it's going to be just kind of yellow-white. So we don't have any green stars. Green stars would not come with the corresponding amount of blue and red that is guaranteed to come with them from these corresponding spectra. Okay. So let's actually try and take a look at the light from these guys. Pass that one that way. You want one? Grab one. In fact, grab two. I'll do it like that, I guess, since it seems like it's a big divide. Let me grab one before they go. So the way this thing works is it has a piece of that diffraction grating, that plastic, in the eyepiece. And that's going to take the light and break it up into various directions. And of course, from our point of view, we're going to aim this hole at the light source. But we're going to see the light coming not from that direction, but from a deflected direction because of the action of the diffraction grating. And what you should see over here is a scale. A scale that looks a lot like this. And all the colors of the rainbow, if it's working right. Sometimes it's hard to get the little slit in there. Okay, because they're separate light bulbs, I see three separate lines of color going from red to orange to very little bit of yellow to green to blue to violet. Is there anyone who doesn't see that? You don't see it. You do see it. Okay, so just as kind of a quickie quiz, if you look at If you look at between 5 and 600, what color do you see? So closer to 500 than 600. Green, yeah. And how about a little bit beyond 600? What color is it? What color is at 600? Say again? I would call that red myself, but we talked about color. And how about at shorter wavelengths in 500, it may be 430 or so. 430 or so. What color is that? The quiet color. Nothing? Shorter than 500, I would say at 430 or so. So if you use the top state scale between 3 and 2.8, I'd call that violet myself. Okay, so those are incandescent lamps. Let's aim it at these guys, at the fluorescent lights. And these aren't going to be exactly what the fluorescent light is, but I claim that you're going to see something like that. You're going to see mostly black with a few colored lines. So what are the most prominent lines there? Give me the number. Works probably better if you look at lights that are even more overhead than at me. No one sees anything? A little bit louder? 535. So 435 is what? Violet. I see that one. Say again? Well, there is something at 480 or so. I would call that teal myself. At 2.85. Yeah, 2.85. I would call that violet. But that's about 435 on the lower scale. So the lower scale is the wavelength in nanometers. I don't particularly want to tell you what the upper scale is. Okay, so what's that about 540 or so? Say louder? Green. And what's the other prominent line that's in there? At what wavelength? About 600. So these fluorescent bulbs are producing an emission spectra, and the incandescent bulbs are producing a continuous spectra. How about making the other sort of spectra, the absorption spectra? So these are some light bulbs that are made from by GE. They claim they have extra nice properties. They're called reveal bulbs. It's supposed to make your furniture look better. What do you see when you look at them? Nothing in particular? It's a boisterous class this morning.
Can we leave the yellow?
Yeah, the yellow is gone, right? They're two kind of big black bars that are covering up where the yellow should be. You believe that? I see skepticism. Anyone else see that? Yeah, some people do. So again, you want to aim the slit towards the light and then look over to the side. And I see, you know, the usual colors of the rainbow, but right where the yellow is, there's black. Two black bars. A little bit over 550, maybe 560. And if you look at these light bulbs, not with their own light, but with the classroom lights, you'll see that they have a coating on the outside. So these bulbs are coated with some material that is apparently absorbing the yellow color of light. So you've been so boisterous that I want to make sure that you actually are seeing these colors. So we're getting into groups of three. And this is your last time in college to play with crayons. I don't know, can be groups of two if you insist. So I want you to accurately portray what you see. And we'll turn off the lights again in a second. So let's start with the continuous thermal spectra from the incandescent light bulb, the normal Edison type light bulb. So put the colors in the right spots. These things can get out of alignment, so it's not... Well, it works for me. Remember, you have to look to this, you have to aim the hole that's in the front, aim this thing at the light source, then you want to be looking to the side. Pretty much done. Almost. It's always fun to compare different people's. Ah, good. So we're good? So on to the fluorescent light bulb.
but it's like a little light in between.
Say again?
The yellow is kind of like, you can see like light lines.
So I think if you look carefully, you'll see that there's more than just the lines. There is kind of a background color, not as bright as the lines, that's also present.
Should we draw that too?
Yeah, draw what you see. But certainly the first thing you notice is the lines. That's the thing to start to draw. So you can see that the light that's produced by these fluorescents is nothing like the light that's produced by the incandescent light bulbs. And the sun is very similar to the incandescent light bulbs. It's shining because it's hot. So you may notice when you buy clothes may look differently under fluorescent light bulbs than they do in sunlight or under incandescent light bulbs. So these things are designed to try and simulate white light with just the right combinations of these various colors. Whereas these things are trying to simulate the sun just by making a hot object. It turns out that lots of the sun's light and lots of these light is infrared light, which is kind of wasted on us, which is why they're a whole lot less efficient than these guys are. But these guys are doing a poorer job of representing all the colors of the rainbow. And it might be worth reminding you that these sort of curly fluorescent light bulbs are exactly the same as these things. They're not fundamentally different. They've just curled up the light bulb into a curly cue. Okay, good for fluorescent. So, Reveal, this trademarked GE product. So it's kind of interesting to look at the solar windmill wind up as it absorbs energy and momentum from the light bulb. Question? Another minute or so on reveal. Good to go. So the fluorescent light bulbs that we have are intentionally designed to kind of reproduce white light. But if you put different things inside those fluorescent tubes, you get different results, right? So this, and I suspect your spectroscopes aren't, that it's dim enough that you can't really look at it effectively. This is the light that you get from hydrogen. So if you were to read the label on this, it would say danger high voltage. Basically what's happening is a big voltage drop is occurring between the top and the bottom of this tube that contains hydrogen gas. And you get this kind of red color, and there's also a little bit of blue color in there if you look carefully. And if you look in your book ahead, you'll see lots of pictures of nebula that are colored red. And that's because the universe is mostly made out of hydrogen. So the same process that is producing this red light on this tube is producing that red light in the sky. So probably the second most common element in the universe after hydrogen is helium. And this is the light you get from helium. It's a different color. Different colors for different elements. In fact, you can determine what element is being excited, is producing the light, just based on the color. So you may know about mercury lamps. Often parking lots are illuminated with mercury lamps. These days also sodium lamps, which are kind of red. So this is kind of the blue light you get from exciting mercury. So every element has a distinct combination of colors. It's kind of like a distinct musical instrument. It's producing its own set of tones. This is krypton. Yeah, I guess we could go through 100 some examples if we wanted to. It looks very similar to helium to me. But in detail, the wavelengths that are being produced by each one of these elements would be different. I don't know if I can read the label on this, but I'm thinking it might be neon. If so, it'll be obvious, because you all know what neon lights look like. Nope, it's not neon. I assume the last one is neon, but we'll see. Oh, there's more than one last one. I think this one is, I think I could read this one as neon. Right, so. Right. That you've all seen before. I can't read the label on this one. Actually, I think that's helium again, would be my guess. Okay, so every element is going to produce its own distinct colors when it's excited, pretty much like a musical instrument produces its own distinct set of tones, and it makes the elements identifiable. Okay, questions? So we're going to want to talk in detail about why it is that different atoms produce different colors. Right, so again, This is actually the color that you get from hydrogen. There was that red, there's a little bit of blue, and on it goes. And this is the light that you get from something like the sun, which is shining simply because it's hot, some sort of incandescent object. So there's kind of a long story that's involved in the why of this atomic effect, that atoms produce different colors. But let's start kind of in a different direction. Let's talk about other sources of light and how they're made. So, more in the form of review than anything else, we've seen incandescence, right? Any object that is hot any object with a temperature, which is pretty much any object, is going to produce a characteristic spectrum, a continuous spectrum. The brightness is going to be proportional to the temperature to the fourth. The peak wavelength is going to be proportional to 1 over the temperature. So the walls in this room are producing light. If we turn off the lights, they look black, but that's just because our eyes don't go to the infrared light that they're producing. Then we have these fluorescent lights, these atoms that are making light. And as I say, this is going to be kind of a long story, so we'll put this off to the future. So what other types of light are there and how are they made? Well, we got a list of types of light here, right? Radio light. How is radio light made? For sure, yep. So all of these on top are below the visible spectrum. All of these except the thing labeled visible are above the visible spectrum. But how is it made? What's required to make radio light? A radio station is required to make radio light. Yeah, so we need, you've all seen radio stations, right? They have this big antenna, and you may have noticed that they are actually connected to the power grid. So they are sending electricity up and down this antenna at whatever frequency they're running, right? So if they're running at 100 megahertz, they're sending electricity up and down through a cycle at 100 megahertz. And as a result of these electrons going up and down, we're going to get these regions of concentrated electromagnetic stuff that are going to be radiated out 360 degrees from that antenna. So all that's required is electrons going up and down the wire. There's nothing fancy about the antenna. Any old wire will do. How does your microwave make light? Not the little light bulb on the outside, but the thing that cooks the food on the inside. Magic. Now, of course, it's connected to NSP eventually too, so it must the ultimate source of energy must be from from NSP. But the question is, how is that NSP energy transformed into microwave energy? What's the immediate source of that invisible to us light? Now, this is what's inside your microwave. It's called a magnetron. And, you know, the name is indicative. There's a magnet there. So, of course, the magnet by itself doesn't do much, but the magnet is producing a magnetic field, of course. And there's a magnetic field in light, but there really isn't any direct relationship between that magnetic field and the light's magnetic field, because this is a steady magnetic field from a magnet, whereas light's magnetic field is constantly changing. So what happens is we shine electrons into this region, and they are orbiting in that magnetic field at extremely high speed. They're going around the magnetic field a billion times a second, in order to make light that has a wavelength of, roughly speaking, billion cycles a second. So in this case, it's an electron going in a circle. And there's nothing special about electrons, either for the radio antenna or for the magnetron. Any charged particle that is either going up and down a wire or is circling in a magnetic field will produce corresponding type of light. How about infrared light? How do we usually make infrared light? Yeah, so we usually call these things heat lamps, right? So these are the little bulbs that McDonald's puts your burger under to keep it warm. And all they do is take a hot object, which is hot because it's which is producing light because it's incandescent, but it's not so hot that it's glowing visibly. It might glow with kind of a dull red, the same way the toaster thing glowed with dull red. But even if that toaster thing is not obviously red, it's still producing infrared light that's, when it's absorbed by your hamburger, can keep it warm. So we're skipping over visible light for the time being. How about ultraviolet light? Anyone ever seen a black light tube? Something that's producing black light, which is what ultraviolet light is. What does it look like? Yeah. Yeah, it looks a whole lot like a fluorescent tube, doesn't it? And that's because it's working pretty much the same way this fluorescent tube is. This thing is just designed to simulate white light, and the black light tube is just designed to not produce much visible light, but instead to produce ultraviolet light. So when we talk about how these fluorescent lights work, that'll be the same mechanism that's involved in the black light tubes. How about X-rays? So the dentist turns a knob, and what happens? How does the X-ray tube work? Well, this is an X-ray tube. And I'm not sure what you can see from where you sit, but it's really, well, I'm not sure what to say it's most like. So there's a piece of this that would shine like an incandescent light bulb. But that's just producing electrons. And instead of having the electrons go in a circle, what's happening here is the electrons go through a big voltage difference, thousands of volts, and they're accelerated up to a good fraction of the speed of light. And then they run into this copper finger. So what's happening is those electrons come to a sudden stop, and it's that stopping of the electrons that produces the X-ray light. So this is called Bremsstrahlung. I have to spell it right once. It's a German word. I wonder if the SS isn't an SS, but that's usually how it's spelled in English. And it just means breaking radiation. So the electrons are accelerated to high speed. And they're stopped quickly. And it's the stopping quickly that makes the breaking radiation that is Bremsstrahlung. There's kind of a fancy word for this microwave light. It goes along the same way. It's called synchrotron radiation. Gamma rays. Incidentally, the Greek letter for gamma is that. Gamma rays. What do you associate with gamma rays? Bad science fiction? So gamma rays basically come about through nuclear processes. And what's going on with gamma rays turns out is very similar, except at a nuclear scale as opposed to an atomic scale, that's going on in these fluorescent light bulbs. So we're kind of delaying that for a few seconds. So what's the common... what's common to all of these types of radiation? What's the ultimate source? Say again? Protons. Is that what you said? Because I haven't mentioned protons. I've mentioned electrons lots of times, but I always said that it didn't matter, that any charged particle, if it was doing what the electron was doing, would produce the same type of light. So I guess with that hint, what you need is electric charge. And what does that electric charge need to be doing in order to be producing light? Well, not just moving. So an electric charge that's moving at a steady velocity won't produce light. It has to be changing. So electrons that are, any charged particle whose velocity is changing, that's all that's required for producing light. So the electrons going down in the antenna, the electrons going around in circles, Bremsstrahlung. Under all of those cases, we have electrical charge that's changing its velocity, and that's what's the fundamental source of all types of light, accelerating electric charge. Okay, so we've left this big gap about how these fluorescent lights work, how this guy works. And I think the only thing I've said is this word atomic, or nuclear in the case of gamma rays. So we need to work our way up to that sort of statement. And let's start with what's called the states of matter. So this is a pretty straightforward idea. We can have water that's in solid form. We call that ice. We can have water that's in liquid form. We usually just call that water. We can have water that's in gaseous form. That's water vapor. And it's all water. It's just a matter of how it's stuck together. So in the case of solids, the things are stuck together cheek to jowl, and we've said they're vibrating around according to the temperature, and that's what makes a solid. A lattice of atoms. So your salt is chlorine ions and sodium ions kind of packed cheek to jowl, vibrating around a little bit if it's hot salt. Solids are made of those sort of common things. So if liquids, and of course what's happening here is we're increasing the temperature, and by that what I mean is we're increasing the motion, the kinetic energy of the atoms that make it up. We've got liquids. So instead of this atom always being next to that atom throughout time, these guys are jostling around, kind of like a crowd. They're still pretty close together, but they're not flying around freely. And we've got our gas. That's where the atoms are actually flying freely. And we saw in that little animation that there's a state of matter that's even hotter than gas called plasma. And that's where the atoms have been broken apart. And in using those words atoms, I'm kind of already getting myself into trouble because we haven't really talked about what is the structure of these atoms. So if we think about something like water, H2O, you know that what you have is an oxygen atom. We have kind of the Mickey Mouse Club picture. We've got two hydrogen atoms connected to a single oxygen atom, and this combination is stuck more or less rigidly together, so that this guy is always next to that guy. So things like this that consist of multiple atoms hooked together are called molecules. And the atoms are the fundamental bits that make up molecules, right? So we have a periodic table of, I don't know what the number is now, 120 or so separate sort of entities that can be hooked together to make various molecules. Yeah, it looks like we need to quit at that point. So turn in, kind of put towards the central aisle, or back in the box, the spectroscopes.